WHDH Radio News and Public Affairs present the Harvard Law School Forum, transcribed earlier for rebroadcast at this time. Tonight we bring you some of the highlights of the discussion on unrest within the Democratic Party. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt is the principal speaker. The panelists include Professor Robert Wood of MIT, Professor Murray Levin of Boston University, and Patrick F. McDonough, president of the Boston City Council. Now, here is tonight's moderator, the dean of the Harvard Law School, Irwin N. Griswold.
The program calls now for the three panelists to speak. Each will have 10 minutes in which either to comment on things Mrs. Roosevelt has said or to present points of their own. Following the talks of the panelists, there will be a general question period open to the members of the audience, and they are asked to come down in front to the microphone at that time. Our next speaker has a dark past. He went to Princeton. That, however, is something that can be overcome. And I think it's fair to say that it has been overcome because he has since taken 2 degrees from Harvard. He has an MPA here in 1947 and a PhD in 1949. He has had a varied career in government service, including the Office of Management and Organization of the Bureau of the Budget, and he is now a consultant to the Bureau of the Budget. For the past several years, Dr. Wood, who is our next speaker, has been at MIT, where he has a special interest in urban studies. He is the author of numerous articles and books, one of which recently published is Suburbia, Its People and Their Politics. He has another book forthcoming entitled 1400 Governments. I'm glad to introduce to you Dr. Robert C. Wood of MIT.
Dean Griswold, it's an honor to follow Mrs. Roosevelt, though it is not an easy task. And I thank you particularly, ma'am, for your kind words with respect to the intellectuals. I think you can see that your counsel has already been taken. When the Harvard Law School has to reach out to MIT and BU to fill the staff of a forum, you know that the ranks of Dean Griswold's staff has already been depleted, indeed. You spoke, Mrs. Roosevelt, of the need to rethink the role of the party system in general, and the Democratic system in particular, the Democratic Party, throughout the country. I want to, if I may tonight, confine my remarks primarily to the Democratic Party, its situation, and its future in Massachusetts. And as I do so, I will probably be elaborating more than extending the remarks of Mrs. Roosevelt. Textbooks assign commonly two functions to a political party. It should, one, have some programmatic or ideological goals that can be distinguished from the other, and it, too, should win elections. Generally, the interpretation of the Democratic Party, or all American parties, and particularly in Massachusetts, is that we have failed in our programmatic responses, and we have sacrificed meaningful platforms in exchange for votes. My thesis tonight is going to reverse this appraisal, and I will argue that recent events have established both nationally and statewide the fact that parties divide fairly distinctly so far as programs are concerned. What has happened to the modern party, and particularly the Democratic Party in Massachusetts, is that the label hurts and does not help to win campaigns. Let me make this proposition in a summary fashion. Let me point out simply that as you can discern, Republican and Democratic positions on major issues at the national level on inflation and tight money versus a Samuelson-Harris sort of fiscal policy, on taxation, on agriculture, on aid to cities, on labor unions, so you can discern in Massachusetts specific and systematic differences between the two parties. It has been a traditional difference in Massachusetts for the Republicans to stand for sales and excise taxes, and for the Democrats, when governors went along with the party, to stand for the income tax. It has been traditional in this state for the Democrats to move more toward the help for large cities and towns and for metropolitan areas than for the Republicans. It has been a tradition in this state for the Democrats to move to finance mass transportation in terms of direct state aid and management, for the Republicans to look more often to the bankruptcy courts. It has been a tradition in this state for the Democrats to move more strongly for constitutional reform by popular convention than the Republicans. But while you can distinguish, it seems to me, on systematic programmatic issues, the differences between Republicans and Democrats in the state as well as in the nation, the function of the party, or the capacity of the party to win elections, has systematically declined. The president is not a man known either in this state or the nation at large, the man who relied on the traditional avenues of party organization and party support. Governor Volpe, I remind you, ran voting for the man and not the party. The outcome of the recent mayoralty of Mr. Collins and Mr. Powers is popularly attributed to the fact that Mr. Powers looked more like the professional Paul. And I can remember in this room in October, in a rally of distinguished academics who were gathered here to do honor to President Kennedy and to associate him with party difference, with party platforms, and with a spirit of liberalism, a sea of thunderous silence when one questionnaire asked how the professors would vote in the state election. In each of these particulars, being a Democrat, I think, in recent years has hurt elections, not helped. Mrs. Roosevelt gave you, of course, the quick and the obvious, and I think the correct answer of why this is true. For the fixation on the Democratic Party in this state, particularly, has been a fixation on its corruptness. Not that there was a meaninglessness of party labels, but that the core of the cry and the outrage from Judge Wyszanski through the Christian Science Monitor pointed to instances of wrongdoing and misfeasance. More precisely, it seems to me, what has occurred in Massachusetts, as in many other of the big cities that Mrs. Roosevelt mentioned, is a striking rise in the popularity of middle-class virtues, of thrift, honesty, and personal morality in public life. The emphasis has come in recent years, as the process of assimilation has gone on, upon law rather than kinship, upon legal behavior rather than personal behavior. The emphasis has been on business employment rather than public employment in every family search for status. And the Protestant ethic, in terms at least of its symbolic account, has been embraced in this state with strict financial accountability, with personal honesty, with decorum in behavior, making more political capital in Massachusetts now than it has for generations. I don't deprecate this movement toward a new morality. I don't scorn in any way the capacities and the need, as Mrs. Roosevelt points out, for the Democratic Party in this state and in general to move against graft and corruption. But I would leave three cautionary notes with you as we embark upon what is a new role and a new concern in party affairs, and I think the real source of party unrest. First, I would point out that it is a relative proposition that we are dealing with when we fix our attention on corruption in party politics, and it is well to remember both the historical progress that has been made in this respect and its present real state. Young groups who venture out in search of to do battle against immorality in politics should not, I think, believe that they have rediscovered the Ten Commandments, or particularly that they have a monopoly on it. And I think we should remember that the sociologists can ascribe our values in relative and middle-class terms. Second, no matter how we feel about corruption or dishonesty or graft within a political party, I think it is important to remember that programmatic differences remain in state as well as in nation. It is fashionable these days to have only a slight tie with the party. In terms of one of my MIT students who came to me proudly the other day to say that he had been elected chairman of the Young Republican Independent Committee for Norman Thomas. But it seems to me that one remembers and should remember that there are differences and workhorse and work to be done within the party itself. And finally, I would like to point out that as well as a problem of new talent and new blood, there is a problem, and to my mind, the central problem of finance. Money, as much as men, are accounting for some and the great deal of the pressures that play upon the practicing politician of either party today. Alex Heard has estimated that the 1952 election cost $140 million across the nation for nation, state, and local elections of that year alone. Certainly, the elections in 56 and 1960 are not cheaper. And it seems to me if we are going to hope for a relief of the awesome pressures when a man runs for mayor at the cost of $500,000, or for the governor and the Senate at a cost of $1 million, we must find, along with good talent, some way to relieve this kind of pressure. There are, as most of you know, awesome limitations to trying to limit financial campaigns itself. But it seems to me we can at least begin to think about limiting the modes of campaigns. We could, for example, ban uniformly billboard advertisements. We could, for example, put a limit on TV spectaculars. We could, for example, control the types and the frequency of appearances of major candidates. At least I think these are specifics to think about as one moves on to reorganize and to restore a party in this state which has had a historic function of assimilating and making Americans from many generations and from many countries, and that now that this job is completed, as I think the task of moving on to make sure that it continues to stand for liberalism and progressivity in the Commonwealth as well as in the country as a whole.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. One of the problems of a citizen in politics in this Commonwealth is the business of people with similar names, sometimes the same name. As you well know, we have had two different John F. Kennedys running for public office in this state for a good many years, and how many people have voted for one of them thinking they were voting for the other, no one will ever know. I have felt a special problem about this because, turning to another similarity of names, there is a graduate of the Harvard Law School named Ianella, spelled with an A at the end, who has been a member of the legislature. There is also another person in politics in this state named Ianello, spelled with an O at the end, For a long time, I thought they were one and the same person, and I found myself somewhat disappointed at times at what our graduate was doing, and have since apologized to him for my egregious error. Well, now, as some of you may or may not know, there are two persons active in politics in this state named Patrick McDonough. One is currently a member of the Governor's Council, and he is not with us tonight. The other one, named Patrick F. McDonough, is our next speaker. He is a graduate of the Boston University Law School, having previously gone to Boston College, where he did his work in biology. He was elected to the Boston City Council in 1956 and is now in his third term there and his second term as president of the council. It seems to me most appropriate that in this discussion of a political problem, we should have at least one person who is actively engaged in politics. And on that basis, I present to you Mr. Patrick McDonough, president of the Boston City Council.
Thank you, Dean Griswold. Mrs. Roosevelt, fellow panelists. Well, I feel perfectly at home here at Harvard, or I feel as I ever felt whenever I was inside a classroom or within any campus. I find myself totally unprepared. I find the two professors, my co-panelists, entirely prepared, and I have my 10 minutes. In the invitation extended to me by Mr. Berman, I think it said that Mrs. Roosevelt would speak and that I would then have 10 minutes during which to comment on her talk, or I might use it to question her. At least that's the impression I got by the invitation. And again, let me say that I'm... feel put upon by the teaching profession. Let me try for a moment to talk a little bit about some of the things that Mrs. Roosevelt said and that Professor Wood said. First of all, my wife, who's sitting out there, must, after all the talk about graft and corruption, be wondering what I'm doing with all my money. And I couldn't help but breathe a sigh of relief when Mrs. Roosevelt said she knew a great deal more about New York City than she does about this city. I think that the problem here in Boston is considerably different than it is in New York City, although I must confess that I know just about nothing about politics there. Here it seems to me that we are nowhere near as well organized. Every 4 years or so we run a morality play, one description or another, to decide who's going to run the city for the next 4 years. The good guy runs against the bad guy. There isn't too much talk about what either is going to do, or if there is, it's very perfunctory, and it might take 1 minute out of any half-hour talk by any candidate. The electorate makes up its mind at some stage of the proceeding which is the good guy and which is the bad guy, and the good guy is elected, and the bad guy goes home to bleed a while. You know, that's... We've been through it recently here, and as I see it, and as probably as Professor Levin will elaborate upon during the course of his remarks, That's pretty much the way things are run here. As a member of the city council, you probably know that I run throughout the entire city. We run at large. And in the year that the mayor is running, there's a mayoralty campaign. The city council fight pretty much gets lost in the shuffle, as does the school committee campaign. Here, it isn't a question so much what organization or what group or party. As a matter of fact, we run without a party label. We've done away with that in the city of Boston. I guess we're above it or below it, or we're somewhere in there. We're running a nonpartisan election. I think the idea behind that, when it was started by some sneaky Republican, was that perhaps they can get one of those fellas in that council or into the school committee if we don't have to state which party we might be affiliated with. It hasn't worked out that way. It's still 9 stalwart Democrats on the city council, and I think the same situation on the school committee. Of course, as a matter of fact, the fact that we have a nonpartisan election greatly helps the Republicans who live within the city of Boston. It makes them it gives them much more strength and much more power in the election than their numbers might entitle them to, because they are, in effect, often the swing vote. And the candidate that, especially in the mayoralty fight, that appeals to them more, they will vote for, and it usually will be enough to tip the balance in favor of that candidate. So that this nonpartisan setup that we have at the present time does make the Republican vote within the city of Boston important. As I listened to some of the talk concerning corruption, concerning graft, and concerning other the like, and concerning, well, compromising yourself. As you sit in the classroom and as we hear an issue discussed one way or the other, I'm sure that probably 100% of us would find that we are definitely on one side of an issue, or we find it a great deal easier to make up our mind on any particular issue. Once you get into government and you have to decide which way you vote, you sometimes find that you're voting in one direction, that you're being patted on the back by everybody. The newspapers say you're a great guy. All the business community comes in and says you're a great guy. The fellow who might be employed by the agency that whose vote you affect says you're a wonderful fellow, and yet you know in your innermost soul that you sold out. At other times, you'll find yourself voting. You'll find yourself voting right. You'll have the happy coincidence sometimes of being praised and honestly feel that you've cast a vote that is a good vote. How this can be, I don't think I can very well explain by standing here for the next 10 minutes or the next 15 minutes. But I assure you that it is true, and that it's a great deal easier to discuss this question clinically in a classroom, and an entirely different proposition to sit down in a legislative hall, be asked yes to vote yes or no on a subject, vote and be convinced that you cast a correct vote. There's the legitimate, you usually hit with the legitimate argument, fallacious argument. You have friends approaching you that you can't imagine where they've come from, or friends of friends of friends of friends, and the pressure builds up, and before you know it, you don't know. You're voting wrong, you're casting a bad vote, and you don't even know it. Essentially, it seems to me that the crux of our problem here in the city of Boston consists of a breakdown in communication between we in government and the people who put us there. I think that the people who put us there, if they were sufficiently informed, would know which vote was a bad vote on a particular question and which vote was a pretty good vote, or which vote, even though it was bad, was at least an honest vote, and which vote, though good, might be a bit dishonest. But actually, in point of fact, there is no real communication between the electorate and the people whom they represent. The stories, the questions are discussed in the newspapers, but as they are discussed and after having lived through them, and then going out and reading the papers and seeing how they're written in the papers, you're caused to wonder, are they talking about the same thing? We could, for example, have a debate in here, I assure you, as to whether or not this is a rectangular room or a circular room, or whether there is a balcony there or isn't a balcony. Three of us could take the side that there is no balcony, and the rest of us could insist that there is a balcony in this room. We could read the papers tomorrow morning, and we will get the impression that there is definitely a question as to whether or not there is a balcony in this room. That's the way they come out. And you get the feeling as you're in there that you're bound to develop a cynicism, a feeling that you can take any side of any question and argue it, and that you'll have a certain amount of the electorate who will believe, who will be with you, a certain amount of them who will be against you. And I think I think that is the basic trouble with our operation here in the city of Boston, a complete breakdown in the communication media. What the answer is, I don't know. We have public hearings. We advertise. We announce in our Boston press paid advertisements that we're going to have a public hearing on an issue that's extreme importance, we think, to the electorate at large, and maybe one or two people who will probably come in to keep warm if it's in the wintertime. Will come and listen to us. That is one or two disinterested people, one or two people who aren't who don't have a definite interest on one side or the other. On the other hand, we'll have maybe a representative of the Chamber of Commerce, a representative of the Retail Trade Board, a representative of the Real Estate Board, who will appear and contact us privately and have a very, very definite view of the situation. And insist with, they think, all due propriety that we vote in a definite way. And I suppose that they're entitled to do that. The newspapers then usually will find, for some reason, will lean in the direction which they have taken. Maybe only because they're the only ones who've come in and expressed an interest in it. And that way, often votes are influenced. There's one little item I might mention before I quit here, and it's this, that when I got elected to the city council, I don't think I was in office a week before I knew, before I had been introduced to and talked to representatives of the Chamber of Commerce and the Retail Trade Board, and Municipal Research Bureau and other groups who are interested in legislation which we handle. I think I was in my second term. One day I happened to be walking by the mayor's office, and the fellow who represents all the municipal employees in the city of Boston happened to come walking out of the mayor's office, and that was the first time I'd ever laid eyes on him. I think that gives you some idea of just what we are faced with. I'm sorry, I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't better prepare this. I wasn't actually aware that it would be
better had I done so. However, I've enjoyed very much this opportunity to listen to a great lady that has addressed us, and I thank you for being so kind as to listen to me.